Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead and be seated.
Thank you.
Okay, our first matter on calendar this morning is docket number 67698, Davidson versus Davidson. Mr. Mills, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay, come on up, sir. Would you like to reserve any time?
I have asked the Madam Clerk to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Madam Clerk, members of the court, my name is Gregory Mills and I represent the appellant. I'm also here with Dan Anderson. Your Honor, this case, this appeal, arises from an order that came from district court based upon the appellant's motion to enforce the decree of divorce. That motion was denied because the court applied NRS 11190, the statute of limitations. The first issue is whether or not this order that's come up is appealable. And obviously it is. We're here. We believe it is. It's a special order. When you look at NRAP 3AB8, it defines what a special order is. It's an order after a final judgment. And that's what we have. We have the decree of divorce, which was the final judgment order, and then we have an order coming afterwards. The Supreme Court in Gum stated that when you have an order that affects the rights of the party after that final order, then it's an appealable order. And in this case, my client's rights to have the equity of home were diminished or removed the moment that order denying the enforcement and applying the statute of limitations. So that's where we're here. The next issue is, does, in fact, NRS 11190 apply to a property division in a decree of divorce? The legislature, for years, have created legislation specifically for family law. The Supreme Court has interpreted that legislation and has made case law specifically for family law. The Supreme Court has made rules that have been adopted and that apply just principally to family law. 16.2 is just the new one that has started to help us get our cases moving faster so that we get discovery done. We have certain rules that apply to us. And also, a major thing that accomplished when I was a runner working for my father was the creation of the 8th Judicial Family Court. And what it did is it made it so that, and hypothetically, a family law lawyers would become family law judges, and then they would understand how families work and how the family unity was different from a civil case or a criminal case that the other judges were seeing.
Well, let me ask you, should a statute of limitations apply in a divorce case, period? Let's start with the basic. Should it ever apply?
It does apply in spouse support, but that's a specific date, spouse support, when it is to be paid, length of time. It gives very specific actions, and it's modifiable. So if there is something that occurs where a family gets back together and live together and no spouse support, there isn't any spouse support paid, the district court can go in and modify that spouse support to make up for that wrong. Because of it has the ability of continuing jurisdiction.
But is that public policy argument you just made equally applicable to a division of property?
No.
Under your theory, you would be dividing property ad nausea forever. When does this ever stop?
I apologize, Your Honor. No. The property settlement agreement is not like a spouse support. It is not able to be modified. So once it's entered, unless it says in there, unless the parties stipulate and put in there, the court retains jurisdiction to modify this property settlement agreement. That property settlement agreement is not modifiable.
Mr. Mills, in this case, understanding from the record was the parties divorced. They then lived together for a period of time, but they didn't seek to set aside the property division or anything else. Is that correct?
That's correct. They lived together for 5 years.
And indeed, during that time period, your client executed and delivered a quitclaim deed to her share of that house, correct?
She did immediately after the Your Honor, immediately after the filing of the decree divorce because the decree ordered her to do it within 30 days. However, it didn't give a date in which he was to pay. And so, getting back to the uniqueness of family court, we use terms like community property, best interest of a child, preserving the community assets, marital waste, terms that you don't hear anywhere else. And the reason why is because we're always looking at the family. What's going to make this family better?
Even Mr. Mills, you talked about these specialty terms, is there any place you can point to where these specialty terms are used as to division of assets? We understand the use of best interest of the child because it's very specific in the legislation and the statutes where they say you must consider, and some other thing you must consider. Is there anywhere in the statute that says you must consider something like this in terms of this timeliness argument you're attempting to make?
They're only when they're dividing the assets at the time, they look at the need, the ability to pay, whether or not who's going to need the assets later, which assets are going to be used for what, and so they look at that.
The good question, it's silent then thereafter.
It is, but let me give you a prime example where silence, and if you put the statute of limitations, can have a horrible effect. A lot of times we have parents who have college funds, and they're in the parents' names. And when you go to a property settlement agreement, they get assigned to parents. Or you have cars that are for kids. But I'll stick with just college funds. They're assigned to the parents. Well, the parents are communicating. They're co-parenting and communicating. They go 7 years, 8 years. And let's say the college fund is in the father's name. Well, if we apply the statute of limitations, it's gone. He decides one day, that little snot-nosed brat is not getting this money. It's his. He gets to keep it.
So should there be tolling? Is that what you're saying? There should be a tolling in that particular scenario?
If you're going to apply 11190, then I would argue the tolling, and I was going to get to that. But as of right now, I'm just saying with property agreements, it shouldn't apply when there aren't any time limits.
But let me ask you this. The statute itself is silent as to any statute limitations. The legislature certainly could have included specific statute of limitations, and it chose not to, or it's silent. And how do you reconcile that with some of the other statutes that do, in fact, indicate limitations of time or no time limit?
Typically, the other issues, the child support, the spouse support, they have time. In order for a child support award to be valid, it has to give a specific time when it's going to pay in a specific amount. Same with spouse support. If either it's lump sum or it's specific. It must give specifics. A property settlement agreement, for example, you could have rental properties where the parties, after the judge decides, hey, we're cutting it in half, you guys each get half of the to be sold, get half of the equity. But because property values are going up and the houses are going up and they have renters in it, they decide not to sell those houses.
So, Mr. Mills, we apply contract principles to property settlement agreements in almost every other context. When they're enforced, we apply contract principles. When somebody's trying to set them aside, why wouldn't we apply statutes of limitations to contract principles that govern property settlement agreements? I don't quite understand the divergence. Just because it's a family court-originated property settlement agreement, that we would treat this contract different than other contracts. Could you comment on that?
The statute itself gives the court the authority to enforce its orders. And then what it does, which is unique, it goes in and names several things, like appointing receivers, things that are already by statute allowed in a normal judgment. That statute, 125-240, not only does it give the court the ability to enforce its orders, but then it names specific things. Like I said, a receiver, garnishments, which are already allowed in other judgments. So why did the legislation do that? And the idea is that with this property settlement agreement, when you're dealing with young children or families, that there may be more to simply executing things that need to be done within the six-year time period.
But you're talking about two different things. You're conflating two different issues. When you've got a contract, as Justice Hardesty said, in a property settlement agreement, that's one thing. When you're talking about enforcement of child support orders, you're looking at 125B050, which specifically indicates regardless of the age of the claim, the court you can maintain actions to enforce. And why couldn't they have done that here? You indicated also that the 11190 is in conflict with 124240. I don't understand why it's in conflict.
It's in conflict because it's conceivable that a property settlement division in a decree, the things that need to be, you know, that the parties would not accomplish those things in the 6 years. For example, a retirement account.
But this is not that case. The quitclaim deed was given in relatively short order, and she could have insisted that her portion of that equity could have been, as the order indicated, given to her, her equitable share.
And Mr. Mills, if I may tag the Chief's question, if we even buy your argument regarding the statute of limitations, isn't it true that adequate evidence, or at least some degree of sufficient evidence, was shown below that your client had already received her share of the equity in the house? I mean, do we need to be concerned about this? Isn't everything?
No. What it came out is she received some of the other property that was awarded in the property settlement agreement that was paid during this time period that they're living together, but not the house. That was never resolved. It was never decided by the court.
So the evidence that was presented by the respondent's client did not go to the equity in the house?
That is our belief when we went over the records during that time period. Yeah, it went to payments. If you apply contract law to this, assuming that NRS 11190 does apply, then when does it start? When does the tolling start? So imagine a couple living together, they're raising children, they're divorced. Is the wife at some point at the notice of entry of decree or at the eve of the 6 years say, supposed to say, hey, honey, you need to sell the house and give me half the equity, even though we've been raising our children in this home, I've got to have it, we're done.
Why wouldn't it relate back to when the quitclaim deed was given?
Because
why would she give a quitclaim deed at that time if that's really the situation? Hey, let's raise the kids and let's wait to execute this or to give any quitclaim deed. Why wouldn't it start from that time?
Because it happens so fast. She does it. She's ordered to do it within 30 days. She does it immediately. Then they move in together. So now she's in the home together. They're living in that house. And so if you do contract law says if time is not of the essence, then it's a reasonable time period. They're living in that home, functioning in the home. What if they would have lived together 6 years? Are we then going to say, hey, too bad, too sad, you should have notified your ex, it's time to sell the home, kids, we're moving, I know it's your senior year, but you're out of here. And so when do you start it? And what we're asking is this court, if you're going to apply the statute of limitations, told after the time that she knew or shouldn't have known, hey, I need to go and protect her. Because she's living in the home. 2011, prices are going up. She knows her assets protected. She then moves out and gets word that it's being sold and files her action 2014. And so told from the time that when maybe she moved out and thought, okay, I need to at some point secure the assets. We're no longer functioning as a family unit. I need to then protect my interest in that home. Because if you do it the other way, unfortunately, you're going to harm parents that decide to co-parent, come back together, and don't realize that the wife or husband needs to force the house, force their hand, and force that, really the house to be sold, because that's usually what it means. Selling the house to pay out half the equity. And that's what it would cause. And so if you're going to apply the statutes, apply contract law, which says a reasonable time, when someone should have known the injury or has become aware of the injury, and apply it from there.
Wouldn't a reasonable time be then when he refinanced the house, had perhaps funds available to pay her interest? That was the last transaction.
And once again, Your Honor, that happened immediately. That happened right upon
7.
It happened in March. So it happens while they're together. It's in his name. But she still...
After he got the quitclaim.
Yeah. And she still believes She knows she owns half the equity. It's ordered. So she's in the home. She knows it. Values are going up. And so she believes that she's protected. There's no difference if it was a college fund that was for the children. There's no difference if it's a PERS account where the guy is 40 and they're talking about their kids and he's like, I'm not going to retire until I can maximize out my PERS. And so the quadro isn't done. And then they're out. If you apply the statute of limitations, that individual doesn't get any of that retirement. It's gone.
You're not saying that this would be recalculated as values were going up, though, are you?
No. No, but her,
back to the original.
She's just saying that the house has been refinanced, house is secured, and so she knows her interests are secured. Thank you, Your Honor.
So under your argument, she could hold this home for 40 years.
Absolutely not. Well,
what would be the limitation? The property is going up. Her interest is secured. Why not sit on it for 40 years when it quadruples in value?
That's correct. She could, but the opposing side may push the issue to have the enforcement of the decree. It's both parties, they're making a mutual decision and communicating about the value of an asset.
Well, the contract says she's to be paid her share based upon an appraisal.
Right.
And so you're saying because the date for which the appraisal was to be conducted wasn't specified.
Or the payment.
Then we're supposed to imply in this contract that that could occur at any time during their lifetimes?
If you're going to apply contract law as you're applying it, then no. If you apply contract law and you apply that the statute of limitation is in play, then it would come at the time when she should have known that she needs to, that the statute of limitations isn't tolling, that she needs to file to enforce that decree. And that would be after the separation because there was no payment date. It wasn't a date saying should be paid a year from now or 2 years from now. And so what if they would have lived together 6 years?
But you don't debate the fact that she could have, at any time, called for her share.
Yeah, she could have forced the family to move out and had that household.
Or she could have entered into an agreement with the husband and said, hey, we're living together, but I'm concerned about this. I mean, she had the decree, and they should have agreed to extend the date for the payment performance. I mean, at some point, the courts have to follow the statutes, and the statute has a 6-year statute of limitations. People can agree to anything, but that's not your argument. You're just saying we should just suspend it and have the courts supervise this postmarital discussion forever once they've engaged. And there's no court, no state in the country that I could find that says these property settlement decrees are not subject to a statute of limitations. And you didn't offer any.
And I didn't. I don't like to offer different states to this wonderful court. But
sometimes that's helpful.
I understand. But if you are going to apply the contract law, and in contracts when we don't give dates of payments, then what is the reasonable time? And you have to look at the uniqueness of, it's not just a contract between two individuals that are doing work. This is a married couple that has children, and they're living together.
No, so, they're unmarried.
Unmarried, but they're living together. It's a code. It's still a family function, and so you need to look at that reasonableness of when is it? When should that time start? When a couple is living together and they're co-parenting and raising a children, raising
they
children.
They have possibly gone back and renegotiated the decree, created another contract. It just seems to, Justice Pickering made a wonderful point that at some point you've got a statute of limitations that the court's bound to follow, and this is a contract.
Yes, and I think it comes down to like contract cases that don't have specific times in them. That we don't put the statute of limitations on a contract the day it's drafted. We don't say, hey, that's when it starts. Usually it's from the last payment, when the last payment is required to be paid. This gave no time.
Mr. Mills, you don't debate that in contract law there is at least an end date. That's different than what you're arguing here. You're saying in family law contracts, no statute of limitation. In contract, statute of limitation.
Yes, just because there is the statute 125-240. If we didn't have that statute that gave the courts the authority to enforce orders after that final judgment, then I wouldn't be having this discussion with the Supreme Court, because then obviously the statute of limitations would apply to that decree, property settlement, like a contract. It's just because we have that statute out there that just says that they can enforce it. But even under contract laws, we have to remember this is a family court case. When was it to be paid? When and just like any other contract, it's from the date of when it was to be paid. And there was no date. There still is not a date.
All right. Thank you. And we peppered you with quite a few questions. I'm going to give you extra 2 minutes.
Thank you.
I'll give Mr. Hoffman an additional 2 minutes as well.
Thank you, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Brad Hoffman. I'm the attorney for the respondent, Chris Davidson. Listening to the arguments which were made by counsel in the briefs, there's been discussion about a couple different issues, and the first issue would be the appealability. And looking at the case versus Gum versus Maynard, in that case, it was a case which there was remaining issues which were brought before the court. And in that case, the court has held that it's a special appealable issue because the issues which remain in that case afterwards needed to be addressed. In this case, there was a final judgment which is issued. And the order which is issued by the family court 7 years later did not change the final judgment which is issued in the family court proceedings in the initial decree. As to the issues which were brought before the court, counsel raises issue regarding 125-240, in which to say that it raises conflict with NRS section 11.190. Under section 11.190, it clearly states that an action on a judgment or a decree, such as a decree of divorce, issued in any court in the United States or any of its territories must be brought within 6 years. NRS section 125.240 does not change the reading of NRS section 11.190. This court, in a case called Lang versus Lang, actually addressed that issue and used that opportunity to express its distinction of a case called X Rel Nexel. And in that case was a civil case. And the Supreme Court held in the Lang versus Lang case that there's other enforcement measures which are necessary in which to enforce decrees because of equity. And that they said that this court has held that the issuance of a receiver which is necessary is done in equity, whether in the other case, which wasn't available because it wasn't available by law. So the court made the distinction in holding that the 125.240 applies to enforcement measures rather than to statute of limitations.
Wouldn't the family bar want this to at least be an appealable issue so that you can have knowledge that there's a statute of limitations on property settlement agreements?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I believe that is an issue that needs to be addressed. I was just making the distinction to raise the issue that was out there for the court to make the distinction between the two.
Counsel, I have a follow-up question to what I asked Mr. Mills earlier. I believe the record indicated that some monies, I won't call it equity, were in fact paid by your client to his client. Was that equity in the house, or was the statement that Mr. Mills made accurate, that those dollars that were looked at below at the district court level were not part of her equity, or not?
Your Honor, there was a motion which was brought, which, if I can digress for how we got to that point before the district court. In September 9th of 2014, a Liz Pendens was filed on the property, recorded on the property. My client filed a motion to expunge Liz Pendens, and simultaneously a motion to enforce the decree was filed as well. During the proceedings, we provided documents which show that there was a barrage of different complaints which were issued by Ms. Davidson. We provided all that information. We provided information which shows that the equity was also provided through the house as well.
So you dispute what Mr. Mills
yes,
said?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Well, the decree was entered November 13, 2006, and it provided in the last sentence dealing with the share of the interest in the property to be paid. An appraisal of said property is to be conducted and the plaintiff to pay one half the equity based on said appraisal. And in that same year, an appraisal was done. Is that right?
That's correct.
So the parties knew in 2006 when the decree was entered what amount would be paid by your client to the ex-wife.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
This court has also looked at another case called Kramer versus Kramer, 1980 case. In that case, this court has held that a property settlement, the court no longer retains exclusive no longer retains continuing jurisdiction on property rights, as the family court retains jurisdiction in custody disputes and in financial matters as well regarding support. Counsel cited a scenario to the court. What happens if the decree provides in language that the parents are supposed to provide money for the children at the period of time which for the college education fund? This court, in a case called Bemis versus Bemis, actually addressed that issue. In Bemis versus Bemis, this court analyzed a decree in which the decree had the requirement that the a life insurance policy was supposed to be afforded to the children in the amount of $25,000 for each child. In that case, this court held that at the trial court, there was a statute of limitations issue, and the court in that case held that the interest which, or the issue that's being brought by the children is separate and distinct from the decree which was entered. And in that case, the court held that there was a claim for conversion which would have a 3-year statute of limitations and established that there was a principle through a constructive trust that would have been established. But in this case, the facts are not analogous to that because, or nor analogous to the example by Mr. Mills, because in this case, it's the same party. So there's no difference between the parties, and there's not a separate right outside of the creole.
Well, let's talk about that point. Mr. Mills makes an argument as special rules for family law, and the legislature has in fact enacted special rules and cases in family law matters. On its plain face, without getting into the facts, just for hypothetical purposes, we have a situation where one party has been awarded the property, other party's been awarded the proceeds for some reason, because they get back together unofficially during a time period. Nothing happens as to the repayment. In an equitable situation, it's almost like a fraud situation. Why shouldn't the party, under certain circumstances, be allowed to come back and seek a declaration for recovery at a later date if they can show they were not paid for this exchange, just from a public policy standpoint?
In response to your hypothetical and public policy point, is that both parties have the public policy belief to that these issues are going to come to an end, that memories are going to fade, documents aren't going to be available, and that they're going to move on with their lives. In an equitable sense, is that a party is going to rely upon that.
Well, why should one party be able to move forward with their life with this gainful gift and the other party be left out in the cold?
Well, I mean, under your scenario, there's if there's a gainful gift, but we're just saying if there's a gainful gift. But there's not, in the facts which we have before the court, we're not saying that there is a gainful gift.
Well, in this particular, we don't have those facts in this case. They were possibly in another case, but I don't see them as part of this case. Is that correct?
Yes. But in addition to that, Your Honor, if somebody would have a cause of action or a claim, they would just have to bring it under typical law, which the statute of limitations applies, under the, whatever rules applies to that.
Wouldn't be in this situation where we have parties, they were married, for whatever reason, after the ink dries, they decide, oh, we made a mistake, we don't want to get remarried, or we want to live together. Equitable considerations, shouldn't they apply so that one party doesn't have unfair advantage over the other party?
I think there would be a slippery slope where we're giving everyone the ability in which to say after the decree has been entered.
Some people categorize marriage as a slippery slope.
Yes, they do.
Counsel, in Kramer versus Kramer, this court concluded that the time limitations under 60B would apply and stated, we reasoned that if the legislature had intended to vest the courts with continuing jurisdiction over property rights, it would have done so expressly, as it did in 125.140 subparagraph 2 concerning child custody and support. Your argument, as I understand it, is this court should be consistent in addressing the application of NRCP 60B and the time limitations as they apply to property rights under 11190.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't have anything further unless the court has any further questions. I don't know if I can reserve time to respond to Mr. Mills. I don't believe that's appropriate.
No, I don't think so either.
I would ask.
Nice. No, that's what happens in family court. This is the same.
A little different.
Can
I approach?
Yes.
Thank you for the 2 minutes. Kramer versus Kramer was a modification of the property settlement agreement, and the court pursuant, there isn't a statute out there that allows you to modify a property settlement agreement. 125.240 is for the enforcement. It's for the enforcement of a property settlement agreement. So it's different than Kramer. Kramer doesn't have a statute basis.
But wait a second. You also have, there's 125B050 suspends the statute of limitations for child support. It says, if a court is in order for the support of a child, there is no limitation on the time in which an action may be commenced to collect the arrearages for that support. To me, that's a powerful statement that if the legislature wanted to suspend the time to enforce a property decree, it knew how to write that kind of statute and could have, but did not. Why isn't that dispositive on a statutory construction analysis? Now, there may be waivers, there may be modifications, but we're supposed to do what the legislature tells us, and I'm struggling with that here.
That definitely would have made my job easier if there was a statute that addressed it like the child support. But the fact is, there's just 240 that is talking about property settlement.
But it says nothing about suspending 11190.
It doesn't. It just gives other means that are already available in forms of collections.
Yeah, I understand your point. I mean, in fairness, I understand what you're saying. I just, as a statutory construction, I think you have a hard row to hoe.
I understand. Going to just Douglas' question, though, about equity. The one thing family courts are is equity. Above any other type of court out there, we are an equitable court. And if you have two parties living together that once loved each other, they're not like a contractor or a subcontractor that enters to a contract and payment of money. She's there living there. And if she would have been living there for 6 years, is she barred because she didn't ask for it? So at least give her the 5 years and then start that statute of limitations after the time she moves out. And that's equitable. Thank you.
So that's an equitable tolling argument.
It is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you for the briefs. Thank you for the arguments today. The matter will stand submitted.